Here it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The head of the State Department of Natural Resources is saying the agency lacks authority to spend money under its Fish and Wildlife account.
The state budget passed last year did not include an Evers administration request to increase license fees for hunters, trappers, and fishers.
And as a result, the agency may have to cut parts of its fish and wildlife management if it doesn't secure funding by this summer.
Now the DNR is asking the legislature for more authority on how to spend its budget in order to shore up the funds for fish and wildlife management, which relies heavily on money generated through license fees.
To tell us more about these developments, we have Danielle Kading, reporter in WPR's Superior Bureau, where she covers the environment, energy, and news from northern Wisconsin. Danny, welcome back to the program. Hey, Danny, can you hear us? I think we're having a bit of technical...
My apologies.
Oh, okay.
I always forget the mute button.
Kate. No worries. You spoke with DNR Secretary Karen Heon yesterday about this structural deficit in the DNR's Fish and Wildlife account. How extensive is the current budget gap?
Yeah, I spoke to her on Tuesday, and basically what we've been seeing over the past few years is that the department has been seeing at least a $16 million shortfall in its budget. And the reason for that is that most resident and non-resident license fees haven't been increased in more than 20 years. And during that time, we've also seen rising costs due to inflation, declining license sales. And those user fees are the primary source of funding for the account. And the DNR supports around 500 positions through that account.
Wow. And last year, in Governor Evers' proposed two-year budget plan, he had sought those user fee increases for hunting, for trapping and fishing. And those fee hikes, they didn't make it into the budget. What happened as the budget came together?
Yeah, well, like many of the governor's proposals, you know, lawmakers rejected raising those fees, and Republican leaders like Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu have been opposed to any large increases in fees that would affect residents or those benefiting from discounted license fees like seniors. So it just didn't make it in there.
Under the current two-year budget, the legislature's Budget Writing Committee Joint Finance transferred $30 million from the DNR's forestry account into the Fish and Wildlife account to avoid this shortfall and make up for the lack of license increases. Why isn't that transfer sufficient to balance the books for fish and wildlife projects?
Sure. Well, the way that it was described to me is that just because the money is there doesn't mean that the agency has permission to spend it. So a budget analyst with the DNR kind of compared it to parents giving their kid a $20 allowance, you know, but telling the kid you can only spend $15 on new books for school or something like that. So basically, the DNR has to ask the legislature's finance committee for permission to use the remaining funds in the account that's being transferred under the budget.
Okay. So what has the legislature said about being able to use this money?
They haven't responded. It's been several weeks, I believe, since the DNR submitted this request for roughly $4 million in spending authority, and they haven't said anything to the agency or scheduled a meeting.
Okay. So going back at the time of the budget writing, Governor Evers said fee increases would ensure critical conservation and habitat management projects could continue. And when you spoke with DNR Secretary Karen Heon, she brought up how spending cuts would impact research.
So there are lots of user groups on the landscape that would have a different experience if we're not able to stock those animals. In addition, some of the requests include things like monitoring and surveys of wildlife populations. That's really important core science work that we do in order to understand, you know, what the deer or grouse or pheasants or prairie chickens are doing out there on the landscape in order to understand their population and then make management decisions accordingly. So how many deer can we hunt this season or how many pheasants can we hunt?
Okay, so much is dependent on the funding in this account. Danny, when does the DNR need to be able to conduct this research in order to have accurate numbers for the hunting season?
Yeah, well, related to all these items, for whether it's hunting, fishing, you know, Secretary Heon said they're going to have to make a decision pretty soon, because a lot of this work takes planning or months to complete. For example, if you are rearing fish to the point where they're ready to be stocked. So in the meantime, the agency is saying it hasn't made any final decisions on where cuts to muskies, walleyes, or trout stocking would occur. And some numbers I just got this morning shows that that 11% reduction overall in stocking is more than 500,000 fish, so more than half a million fish. And that includes like a reduction of more than 40,000 fish, you know, muskies, and specifically, and around 300,000 for walleyes. And so they're hoping the committee will grant this permission to spend those funds. And it is seeking other sources of money in case that doesn't happen. But if it doesn't get permission to spend those funds by July, then the agency would have to pursue those cuts. And we could see the temporary closure of the Brule and Osceola State fish hatcheries in northern Wisconsin. And some of that work could also be shifted to other hatcheries like Les Foyt and Bayfield.
Danny, thank you for the update and your reporting. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is a reporter for WPR. Now we hear how possible cuts to DNR fish and wildlife management could affect people who enjoy these outdoor pursuits. Jim Van Landschoot is president of the Western Lake Superior Trolling Association. Jim, welcome to the program.
Oh,
thank you. The Brule State Fish Hatchery up in northern Wisconsin is one of the hatcheries that could be closing in July if this funding doesn't come through. What can you tell us about this hatchery? What would your region be losing without it?
A lot. Right now, if that hatchery closes, we're going to have a reduction in our brown trout stocking by up to 65%, which is going to affect our fishery. You know, 3 to 5 years down the road, we're going to find out that our nearshore fishery is kind of disappearing. Years ago, we talked about, you know, splake stocking and stuff, and they quit stocking splake, and then they promised us they'd make up the difference in stocking the brown trout. With that hatchery closed, they're not going to be able to supply the brown trout. So we're going to be missing a big part of our fishery.
Can you talk about how this hatchery has been in the community for so long, a little bit of its history?
Yes. Back in 1927, the Douglas County Fish and Game League donated money towards the construction of the hatchery. So that thing's been around for, well, 99 years this year. Instead of, you know, worrying about a closure, we should be planning a celebration for a 100-year anniversary. And that's right now, it doesn't look like that's going to happen.
In the event the DNR has to make these cuts to its fisheries and wildlife management, what effect could this have on people who hunt and fish like yourself? What concerns you most?
We're going to lose a lot of fishermen, I believe, in this thing, because the cuts statewide, they're going to affect every fishery. So I'm thinking we're going to see it. We're going to see less license sales over the years. And I get questions from our members, you know, we're going to cut our stocking by 65%. And they're asking me, why are we paying for a stamp? And I don't really have the answer to that. So
is there any way to make these cuts in a way that would spread them out or make them less painful to any one area?
I don't believe that, because then you're picking and choosing what fish is important to what person. And I don't think that's where we want to go. We want to support the fishery throughout the whole state. And we have taken a position. We've got about 12 to 15 groups involved in it right now. We've taken a position where we don't want to see any facilities closed. We don't want to see any reductions in stocking. And should there be cuts to our Lake Superior fishery, we want the cuts to be equal to Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. That's the position that we're taking as of right now.
You're in the Lake Superior region. How are you collaborating? How are you working with counterparts in other counties to voice your concerns to the DNR?
We've been making a boatload of phone calls. For the last 2 weeks, Tom Johnson and myself, we've been on the phone talking to these other groups and trying to get them involved in. So far, we've gained a ton of support. Everybody seems to be in our corner on this one. Losing that Brule River hatchery, there's an historical value down there to that thing, too. It's a beautiful place to go visit. I remember going down there as a kid right before fishing season and seeing all the fish down there and getting all excited to go fishing. And that stuff's going to go away with these cuts. And it's going to be a sad, sad day for the region.
Would your members, would other groups support higher license fees to avoid these cuts?
Oh, most definitely. Yes.
Did you say most definitely? I'm sorry, we just cut out there.
Yes, I did say most definitely. Everybody I've talked to in our group, you know, it's why haven't we had an increase since 2005? Inflation goes up every year. The cost of the DNR go up every year, but our license fees aren't keeping up with that. And we did try to push for an increase in our trout stamp a few years ago, and that failed. So I guess we're right back at the starting point there again, where we need a license fee increase to make the department solvent.
What impact could any reductions in stocking have on the recreational pursuits, tourism, sporting culture in your area?
Oh, it's going to have a ton of effect. I can't see people are going to be less likely to make this a destination to come and fish Lake Superior with all these cuts. I'm thinking they're just going to go over to Lake Michigan, and our businesses are going to lose out. In the wintertime, but you can't get a hotel room down in the Bayfield, Washburn area that everybody's down there fishing these brown trout. We're going to miss out on all that. The businesses are going to lose out, you know, the restaurants, the hotels, the bars, all that. So we're trying to get them people on board with this too. So they have a vested interest in keeping the fishery solid. Mm.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Jim Van Lanschoot is president of the Western Lake Superior Trolling Association, and we previously talked with WPR reporter Danielle Kading in Superior, and we've been talking about possible cuts to the DNR's fish and wildlife management if the agency doesn't receive more spending authority.
Coming up, indoor vertical farms were sold as the wave of the future. We'll find out why they often didn't work out, why some did, and we'll visit a vertical farm project in Kenosha.
We got to watch all those big vertical farms fail, so we noticed, okay, this is what they're doing wrong. Here's what we're going to do right.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As farmers plant their crops for a new season, some farms are already rolling with products grown indoors. A decade ago, vertical farms were hailed as the future of agriculture, a cheap way to mass-produce food in urban areas with limited resources.
But the vertical farming revolution has yet to arrive. Vertical farming needs a lot of energy and poses some serious engineering problems. Despite these challenges, there are several vertical farms operating in Wisconsin.
We'll talk to one of those operators in a little bit, but first let's get an overview of the industry in Wisconsin. Johanna Osterwijk is the manager of the D.C. Smith Instructional Greenhouse at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes in greenhouse management and plant care. Johanna, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Well, tell us about this basic concept for people who haven't encountered the idea. What is a vertical farm?
Yeah, so a vertical farm is literally growing plants on top of each other. You might be familiar with a typical greenhouse where we grow plants like we would in the field, all spread out. But in a vertical farm, we take those indoors, so we're not using natural sunlight, but since we have to light everything anyway, we're also growing them either in racks or trays or stacks on top of each other. But every layer has associated lights with it. So instead of using natural sunlight, we're using electrical energy to create the photons that drive photosynthesis and help the plants to grow.
I remember about 16 years ago, I was a producer here, and I booked the late Dixon DePommier. He had a book out called The Vertical Farm, and it seemed like this idea, people were really excited about this, got a lot of investment. What was the appeal, at least of the basic concept of the vertical farm?
Yeah, the first appeal is that you can grow plants anywhere and any time of year. So his proposition was to grow plants, you know, right in downtown in major cities where they're right next to the people who are going to eat them. It's still a great idea. I think something that his book didn't really go into was the limitations. It was very much a think piece. And after 10 to 15 years of this concept being acted on, we're seeing some of the drawbacks and really where the sweet spot is for good vertical farms.
Yeah, we were prompted for this in part by a national article in the New York Times that it looked like a lot of investors jumped into this and tried to do this big time at scale without having worked through some of those challenges and limitations. Do you think there was some maybe unwarranted exuberance early on with this concept?
Well, I think anybody who's drawing in investors is going to build up their idea. And we see that with any sort of new investment idea. It gets people excited and makes them want to support your project. In the last, again, 10 to 15 years, we've then seen the same typical fallout that we do. One interesting thing about this is that a lot of those early investments weren't necessarily in growing produce. A lot of the early investors were drawn in because they wanted to be technology specialists. They wanted to support the company that was going to produce the technology, the systems, the racks, the hydroponics that would then be sold to other growers. So really, they were more interested in the systems, the electrical, the plumbing and ventilation than necessarily growing and selling produce. That actually is a much better profit margin, to be honest. Vertical farming is still farming, and you have very low profit margins for selling produce. So one issue that was seen in those was, well, it's not a great farm. No, but we're working on this technology that we want to sell to other folks. And that was often what was sold to the investors, was not that we were going to be a farm and sell produce, but that we were going to sell the technology to other growers. And that was where the investors were going to make back their money.
On the produce growing side of things, what were some of the biggest challenges that we started to run into as we started to really try to put these things into action?
Well, early on, one of the difficulties was that, again, they were trying to produce technology, so they maybe didn't hire plant specialists and ran into what would maybe to somebody who was a experienced plant grower seemed like obvious things. One opportunity is to convert existing buildings into farms. But you have to take into account how plants grow. Of course, you have the light issue. Hopefully that's obvious. Most of our existing buildings aren't going to be set up to capture natural light, so we have to supplement. But many existing buildings aren't set up for the heavy moisture load that's produced by plants. A lot of the indoor farms are growing hydroponically, so you've got the plants growing in a nutrient-rich water, not in a potting mix or soil. And all of those plants are transpiring. They're moving that water through the roots into the plant and out the leaves, and it ends up in the air. So you end up with a building with really high relative humidity, and you may not have thought ahead about providing sufficient ventilation. And also, a lot of these old buildings are made out of steel. And steel, when it gets exposed to water, rusts. So that was, in some cases, an issue where they, you know, took an old warehouse or a downtown factory and the building started rusting around them. And that wasn't taken into account. So those are some of the things that maybe someone who's interested in a hydroponic rack might not really think about the whole environment in the way that a plant scientist would.
Another challenge is if I want to grow plants out of the ground, a key element is free, the sunlight. Whereas you mentioned, especially if I'm using an older building that isn't all made out of glass or something like that, and I'm having multiple levels, that light is an investment. The energy to produce that light is an investment.
Yeah, so you've got two investments there. You have the purchase price of the lighting fixtures, and then you have the ongoing expense of paying for electricity. And if you're trying to replace the light that plants need, especially in a vertical farm, every layer is another layer of light that you have to provide. Whereas in a greenhouse, you're going to grow in one layer and you're going to capture as much natural light as possible. And for most of the year, you'll have sufficient natural light. Maybe in the deep winter, you'll want to supplement. But in an indoor farm, it's all year round, which is the benefit. You want to be able to grow and produce anywhere at any time. But supplementing that amount of light, it's very, very different from lighting a typical office building. Our eyes adjust to lower light. Plants don't. This is their energy source. This is how they produce the sugars that we like to eat. But without sufficient light, your plants aren't going to do well. And that's an ongoing energy cost.
All that said, there are still vertical farm operations. We'll talk to one from Wisconsin in just a bit. Are there kinds of produce that, hey, it seems like this model might work better than others?
Yes, there's definitely certain kinds of produce that work better than others. And that was one of the, you know, initial ideas where we've seen the limits. You don't want to grow just anything. If this, you want crops that are short so that you can stack them up very high. You're not going to do this with apple trees, for example. So you want plants that are short in stature and that also have a very fast turnover. So the more crops you can harvest in a year, that means the more produce that you have and the more you have available for sale. So you want things with a short life cycle and a small stature. You also want to lean into plants that you get a benefit from producing them close to your consumers. So you want perishable produce, not commodity crops like corn or soybeans. You want things that are going to lose some of their nutritional value through shipping or storage. Crops that store really well, potatoes, carrots, turnips, they're not good candidates for this kind of production. You want things like leafy greens, microgreens, small berries, other kinds of small fruits that, again, you can grow quickly and you lose some of their nutritional value or their quality by shipping them long distances or trying to store them for long periods of time.
Then I imagine I'm not going to have my vertical orchard, my vertical apple orchard anytime soon. The greens seem to work pretty well. I'm guessing there's a mid-range of stuff that, hey, I could grow in my vertical farm, but if I'm competing with places with lots and lots of land and lots and lots of labor, I can't do it in a competitive way. Do I have that right?
Yes, you're right. So again, we see mostly those leafy greens, particularly because the light requirements are lower. So again, fruits, you have to grow the plant, you have to get it to flower, and then you also have to produce this sugary fruit, and that takes a lot of light energy to do. If you're just growing the leaves of a plant, maybe the stems, then you don't need as much light. So growing microgreens or growing lettuces, arugula, that's going to take about half to two-thirds as much light as, say, growing strawberries or tomatoes or cucumbers, which have a full fruit, and you need a longer time to produce those, but also just more energy hands down. It's interesting that you mention labor. One possible benefit to indoor farms, again, is having a labor source nearby. So when you're out in a more rural area, you may not have as many people for your labor source. Bringing the farm into the city can bring the work to the people. So it's an opportunity for employment, particularly year-round employment. Many farms are seasonal, so you have a lot of work to do during the harvesting and during the planting season, but maybe you have 4 months of winter when you don't have work for folks. So a benefit to an indoor farm would be consistent year-round employment for folks.
Interesting. Johanna, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Johanna Osterwijk is manager of the D.C. Smith Instructional Greenhouse at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes in greenhouse management and plant care. We're talking about vertical farms. Now let's turn to someone who's been running a vertical farm for a few years. Robert Carlson is co-founder of Grow Space Vertical Farm in Kenosha, which grows greens and microgreens. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What was the inspiration for opening Grow Space with some members of your family?
Yeah, so it was started by me, my dad, and my uncle. It's really been a whole family operation, including my grandma and my mom. Everybody's been involved. And what we were seeing is that we thought we could do produce better ourselves in our own house. So it was just me and my dad. We were messing around in the basement with growing plants, and then it's kind of snowballed from there into now we turned an old furniture store into a vertical farm.
And we were just talking to Johanna there. It seems like the sweet spot for produce is in those greens and herbs and microgreens and things like that. Is that where you have put most of your efforts?
Yes. Yes, it is. So we grow leafy greens, microgreens, and herbs. And we are really lucky because we got to watch all those big vertical farms fail. We started in the past 3 years. So we noticed, okay, this is what they're doing wrong. Here's what we're going to do right now that we can see exactly what doesn't work.
All right. Now, what does it take to take, you said an old furniture building. What does it take to turn that into a vertical farm? Sounds like a lot of work to me.
Yes. And it definitely wasn't no work at all. So what we had to do is first we had to waterproof. So it was a furniture store. So it had a drop ceiling that was not going to be good for our water, right? Any humidity or moisture was going to just absorb in there and cause problems. So we switched all of that to waterproof drop ceiling. We sealed a lot of the seams in the building because it is a concrete building, which is also nice. So there's no wood or anything. It does use steel beams, and those we had to paint over, and we had to basically just make sure everything was waterproof, sealed, and tight, so any humidity didn't become a problem. But those steel beams meant that we could put quite a bit of weight onto the floor so we can build out to all the systems that we need.
Now, I want you to paint us a picture. I walk into this former furniture store, now a vertical farm. What do I see?
Yeah. So you literally just walk right into our lobby, and then there is a beautiful window that goes directly into the farm. So the whole wall, right when you walk in, looks into this farm, and is these basically these massive tubes that have all these plants coming out of them. They're actually like beautiful. Like if you saw them at a park or something, they would be like artistic even. And these beautiful towers grow plants coming right out of them. So you basically walk into this wall of beautiful green and these beautiful towers, bright lights. It's a very futuristic looking building when you walk in.
You mentioned learning from the failures of a lot of other operations that kind of went in not knowing what they were doing. Have you run into obstacles early on that you had to say, oh, nope, we didn't get that quite right? What sort of things did you have to overcome along the way?
So we did have to overcome quite a bit. So early on, we figured out the business model that would work best. And that was we're direct to consumer. So we have a storefront, people walk in, people get greens. Then we sell directly to restaurants. So that was the first hurdle is we noticed that, okay, so basically they're plugging themselves into the system where people can't really appreciate the local greens. So we're direct to consumer. And then what we've run into as well is it's an old furniture store, right? So we run into issues where like, oh, the air conditioning's not powerful enough or the heat's not powerful enough. So a lot of it was, okay, we got the base building correct. Now, oh, we got to do a little more work. We got to put in a new furnace. We got to do this, that, and the other thing to make the space work to grow produce like this.
Now, what do you see as the advantages of vertical farming for products like the ones you're doing and having it, you know, not necessarily out in the country, but in a place like Kenosha?
Yeah. So the big benefits that our customers like is the freshness. That's what everybody absolutely loves. The greens are 2 weeks fresher than they can get from the store. Plus, they have the roots still attached because they're not in soil. That makes the plants last quite a bit longer. And on top of that, we're able to grow without spraying any chemical pesticides, which has some pretty big sustainability benefits, along with the fact that we use a lot less water. At Grow Space, we use around 92% less water, and you can, with hydroponics, get as much as 97% less water usage.
And how about the light issue that I was talking to Johanna about? She said the greens that you're doing, those are the least light hogging of the produce options out there. What do you do to give them the appropriate amount of light?
Yeah, so LED technology is what makes all this possible. It's efficient enough that you can afford the electricity bill every month. And they're able to get the brightness that the plants need to grow. So because of the energy costs, our greens are a little bit more expensive than you would see from the store. But really, that's the only negative that comes from the energy. We get all the benefits of being indoors and year round for a small premium at the end of the day. So basically, we just pay the electricity bill.
Now, Robert, you've got the old furniture store converted into the vertical farm. Is the vision for the future, hey, this is the right size, this is what we want to keep going? Or do you have a notion that, hey, we might want to have a different building, another building to expand this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And what we kind of imagine is that small farms like these will be the standard. Instead of these massive warehouses that get converted into vertical farms, it'll be much smaller buildings like ours, where basically the farm serves just their own community, and that's all it does. So if we were to expand, it would probably be to another building to get that community the greens they need.
Is there another kind of produce you'd want to try, taking the lessons you've learned and the lessons from other failed projects?
Yes, there are. So we would love to do tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, produce like that. But for those, what we'll probably do is we'll probably just do it in a greenhouse instead of doing it indoors, just because of that, you know, that high energy price. Mm-hmm. But we'll see how that does actually end up working out. We're probably a few years away before we're really at a scale that we can, you know, invest in that.
And finally, what are your favorite greens to eat?
My favorite greens to eat. I love our romaine, but that might just be because that's what we grow the most of, so I get to eat the most of it. But it probably is either romaine. I do like our butter crunch as well. Broccoli microgreens as well. Lots of good stuff. I like it all, frankly.
Robert, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Robert Carlson is co-founder of Grow Space Vertical Farm in Kenosha. Earlier, we heard from Johanna Osterweik, who manages a greenhouse and teaches about greenhouse management at UW-Madison. We've been talking about vertical farming here in the state.
Coming up, meet an Artemis II engineer who grew up in West Allis and follow his road to NASA from his Wisconsin childhood.
We would always mess around with the Legos. We'd used to build spaceships and helicopters and things like that. So I think there was some interest in science and space all the way back there.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This month, four astronauts made history, circling the moon for the first time in decades and going deeper into space than any human in history.
The Artemis II was a part of the country's moon mission program aimed at eventually setting up a lunar base.
Behind those astronauts is a team of thousands of NASA engineers and scientists who work to bring them home safely. And we've been checking in with the members of the Artemis team who have Wisconsin connections.
Doug Parkinson is Launch Integration and Mission Operations Lead for NASA's Space Launch System, or SLS, program. He's originally from Wisconsin, growing up in West Allis. Doug, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, I understand you were monitoring the launch at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama. Take us to that moment. What is the mood there? What's going through your mind as you're watching that moment of liftoff?
Oh, my goodness. How exciting it was, all of the things that it took to get there to that moment. And, you know, just the people around me looking in their eyes and all the hard work and the times we shared to get there and watching that vehicle come alive, lifting off the pad, and what it means to each one of us individually, but what it means for us as a country.
Now, we'll talk more about the launch and the future, but I want to get your road from Wisconsin. You grew up, I understand you were born in West Allis. Talk a little bit about your Wisconsin roots.
Oh, Wisconsin roots. Oh, my goodness. It takes me way back. I lived in Wisconsin until I was about 13 years old, 12 and a half, 13 years old, from West Allis. Lived on 76th Street. I used to run around the neighborhood, ride our bikes just about everywhere. Went to Jefferson Elementary School there, and it was such a blast.
When did you figure out that you're going to go into a field, you know, maybe you didn't know it was going to take you to space flight, but relevant fields? Where did you start that career path?
I've always been interested. So when I was real young, back when taking me all the way back to Wisconsin there, when I was growing up, my parents gave us Legos and we would always mess around with the Legos. But between my brothers and myself, I guess I seemed to be the one that tended to spend hours and hours and hours with that. And we'd used to build spaceships and helicopters and things like that. So I think there was some interest in science and space all the way back there. Fast forwarding, I ended up coming to the University of Alabama in Huntsville, where I went to college. And at that school, I was able to get a job in the Propulsion Research Center there. And once we started working on advanced propulsion and things like that, I think my career was starting to take a turn towards propulsion and flying rockets and doing great things with NASA.
Now, we'll get back into the mission again, but did you take any Wisconsin with you to the South and to your colleagues? Are you turning them on to custard or cheese curds or anything?
Bratwurst, of course. And of course, we always have Old Milwaukee and Pabst Blue Ribbon around. But yeah, I guess a little bit of that came with me, of course, and always would tell folks that I'm a cheesehead.
All right. Now, with the Artemis mission, can you talk us through what you and the team you're leading were doing when it came to the liftoff and this mission?
Okay, our team sits, if you think kind of like the Maytag repairman, I may be a little bit over a simplification, though. There's the people at Kennedy Space Center who are pushing the buttons and making sure the vehicle is commanded correctly. But our engineering team here back in Huntsville and actually all across the country are supporting them. So we're the ones that design the rocket, and then we turn over the rocket, or design and build the rocket, and we turn it over all the big chunks to Kennedy Space Center, where they construct the rocket and put it all together and launch it. Well, if there is an issue, or if something doesn't look quite right, and we're monitoring all the way through, is everything operating correctly? Is everything, electrically, with fluid systems and all of that. We're monitoring all of that back in Huntsville and making sure as that rocket's getting ready to launch, everything is within the proper bounds. So that's our role, is to support them during that launch process. And like I said, if there's an issue, they reach back to us and we're right there to support them and troubleshoot and hopefully give them a resolution that allows that rocket to go that day.
I imagine a lot of the work, of course, happens before the launch. What kind of testing are you doing, both on the physical rockets? And I imagine there are a lot of simulations going on. What is the testing looking like leading up to launch day?
It takes years of work leading up to it, with testing from the smallest component level all the way up to the system level. So when we turn those big pieces over to Kennedy Space Center, those big elements over to Kennedy Space Center for vehicle integration, that starts happening, or it had started happening on this particular rocket about a year before it even launched. And then once we get into that process, we put the element by element, the vehicle stacks together. And all along the way, we're making sure as we're adding pieces, we're checking out systems. We even do like an all systems test. And we called that wet dress rehearsal on this time around. And that's when we loaded up the rocket with the cryogenic propellant. And we checked it out. We made sure all the systems were functioning, and we even got close to, we go down to about 30 seconds from T0, and we follow that procedure. So that makes sure that all of our procedures are in place and working correct, or are properly sequenced, and the rocket is also functioning properly. So it's a good way to make sure that the rocket is ready to launch.
Now, I might think, okay, we had the Artemis launch, your work is done for a while, you get to go on vacation, but then I think, hang on, you just got a whole bunch of real-world data that you're going to need to look through. What does it look like after the mission is done for you and your team?
Oh, yeah. I tell you, we call that post-flight analysis, and that takes multiple months to do. We did fly humans on this one, so that added to it. But, you know, we're a science organization. We look for that data. We're looking for that data to make sure everything went well and operated correctly. So we pore over that, and that helps inform us for the next launch.
So months of data to go through. So what does that look like? You're taking the equivalent of like a black box from the rocket, or what are you looking at now?
Oh, well, we get the telemetry of the data off the vehicle leading up to T0, and then in flight we get data all along the way until it's disposed of. So we get that in real time, and it comes down. We either bank it off satellites or it comes down to our ground stations, and we process that. And that takes that can take up to a couple days even to process that after flight. And then all of our engineers look over all of the data and the video, do comparisons, analyze in great detail whether the vehicle acted nominally. Was there any debris that came off or particulate? You know, we just pour over every frame, and we look at every data point to make sure that things were as expected.
We're talking about the Artemis Lunar Program with one of its leading aerospace engineers, originally a Wisconsinite from West Allis, Doug Parkinson, who leads NASA's Space Launch System Program. Doug, if people look over at the history of the space program, they could look back to the 60s and the Apollo program and Gemini and everything going on back then. What has changed in this kind of launch technology? It's been going a long time. I'm guessing we've solved some problems and made some developments over the decades.
Oh, yeah. We stand on the shoulders of giants. So, you know, we've learned a lot through the Apollo program, then the shuttle program, and we've learned decades of experience from operating that vehicle. And that all informs the engineering and design of this rocket. And we even have heritage back through the shuttle program. If you look at the RS-25 engines that we fly on this vehicle, some of those components and engines, those engines were literally flown on space shuttles that we've reused in the past. The booster designs, the big white solid rocket boosters on the side, those designs have heritage with the space shuttle, space transportation system, the shuttle. And we just continue to build on our huge mounds of information that we've learned over the decades since the 60s. And not only that, but computer technology, the amazing computer technology we have now today, we're able to get so much higher resolution video. We have the ability to get a lot more data. Our models are much better now, and we see evidence of that. We've flown Artemis 1 and Artemis 2, and they have performed superbly.
You just mentioned the computer technology involved here, and that's a big part of the job. But I've seen elsewhere you say part of what you like about this is that you get to get your hands dirty actually work with the equipment. What kind of things are you doing as you move back and forth between the computer lab and the actual gear that we're sending into space?
Okay, well, particularly in the HOSC, we have computer consoles that we're sitting at. But so we're utilizing those for data and video and the like while the vehicle is operating. But what I also like to do another part of my job before we ever get to the part we get on console for to support launch is when we go down to Kennedy Space Center and get that vehicle assembled. So every day, the team works, a large engineering team with the technicians. They work on putting that rocket together. And what was a good, a really great experience, actually, for me, is being able to go down there and see the actual pieces of the rocket going together and you know, being oversimplified like a big Lego set or Erector set going together, but in a much more complicated way, in a much more fine-tuned way.
What kind of pressure do you and your team feel under here to get it right? Because you have to get it right. The stakes are very high come launch day.
I take a lot of accountability of what I do personally, and take a lot of pride in what we do. And actually, that is a simple characteristic of everybody on the team. And so we do have a lot of self-pressure, but we do feel pressure from wanting to perform for the country. But we know that if we stay steady and stay true to our engineering roots here, and making sure that we go step by step, walk through things systematically, we have confidence in our abilities and what we can do and perform. But I would say that accountability that we put on ourselves definitely gives us a level of pressure to perform.
All right, now that's Artemis 2. Here comes Artemis 3. Maybe dates next year. There's always, you know, things that can be bumped back and weather windows and things like that. What are the steps now that you're taking to prepare for that mission, ultimately involving a moon landing?
Oh, wow. We're into mission planning. We take our we reevaluate based on the data evaluations we do. We look over and we see if we need to fine-tune anything for the next mission. We're already have a major components, you know, the major pieces of the Artemis 3 rocket already heading in the direction of Kennedy Space Center. So we're making sure all of those things are being processed properly, and we're getting ready in the near future to support Artemis 3, get into that vehicle stacking process once again. So we're definitely looking over what we've done to date and building off of it, and making any fine-tuned adjustments for Artemis 3.
Doug, for that kid out there listening in Wisconsin playing with their Lego set and thinking, hey, maybe I could do what you're doing someday, what is the path? What are the steps they would need to work up to what you're doing?
I would say if you have a dream and you look at the Artemis program, I would go to NASA.gov to take a look at that. And it's inspiring to know that if you can dream it, it can be part of Artemis. You know, you might think, oh, I have to be an engineer. You can be a scientist. You can be somebody that's into photography. You know, all of these different types of career paths, these, as long as you have a dream to participate, it can be part of Artemis and what we're doing. We're going to the moon and we're going to stay, and it takes a lot of infrastructure, and it'll take a lot of people to get there.
Doug, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That's Doug Parkinson, Launch Integration and Mission Operations Lead for NASA's Space Launch System Program, originally from West Allis. We've been talking with Doug about the Artemis II lunar mission and future plans. Yesterday, we talked about a decline in the number of overdose deaths in Wisconsin. We got an email from a listener named Trent in Western Wisconsin.
Trent says he's been struggling with addiction for years, starting at age 19, and has received a variety of treatments, including outpatient therapy, counseling, and medications.
Trent tells us, buprenorphine has been a life changer for me. It allowed me to truly escape the grip of opioids, on which I overdosed many times.
And Trent writes, I see a whole group of incredible professionals at Amplify in La Crosse, and without all of the support, I don't know where I'd be.
Trent closes, today, every day, I am grateful to be alive. Thank you so much for continuing to spread the awareness.
And thank you so much for sharing your story, Trent. And if you have a story to share, let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.